following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
We pray for those, especially in foreign lands. We think now particularly of Pasiang's hometown, of his home village, in which this rainy season causes much illness. We pray, keep thy people in the shadow of thy wing. Grant to them good health, that they might be a light, that they might be that beacon, that light set upon a hill, that those round about them will see that thou dost give thy people health and good success. We pray that thou wouldst establish the work of their hands, and that thou wouldst cause their hands to be strong in thy commandments. And we ask this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Please be seated. Some weeks ago, you may remember that I preached a sort of a mini-series within our Possessing the Land series that I called The Boils of Egypt, The Botch of Egypt. And the first of that three-sermon series had to do with public health, how to keep God's commandments in such a way that your health improves. And I put it to you that if people have water that is treated the way God says to treat water, if they keep cleanliness the way God says to keep cleanliness, that they will be healthier for it. And when there was a plague that was going through Kalamu Tahan some time back, and about the only people that it did not affect was the faculty and the students of the New Life Orphanage. And I'm convinced that the reason that they did not get sick when everyone else did was because God was watching over their health in the context of them having a deep water well, washing their hands, using brand soap. One of the things they make over, you know, brand soap? They make lye soap. And the bran, the chaff, is the... We talked about this in the sermon, about the cedar oil and the wool. Some of you need to go back and review the sermons. Well, this afternoon, let's take a look at Joshua chapter 3, Joshua the third chapter. I'm going to read the first six verses to you. I don't think we will finish with all six. In fact, I've designed this so that we won't finish with all six, but only with about the first three. Nevertheless, I want us to see how all six fit together. Starting at Joshua chapter 3 and verse 1, hear now God's own words. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim and came to Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. And it came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near unto it, that you may know the way by which you must go. For you have not passed this way heretofore. And Joshua said unto the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spake unto the priests, saying, take up the ark of the covenant, and pass over before the people. And they took up the ark of the covenant, and went before the people. May the Lord add his blessing to this reading of his word. You may wonder how much is 2,000 cubits. It's about 10 football fields. So they're out about 1,000 yards in front. A cubit is about 18 inches, about a foot and a half. So 2,000 cubits would be about 1,000 yards, roughly. Are you with me? About 3,000 feet we'll do the conversions, about 3,000 feet, which then becomes about 1,000 yards. So about 10 football fields. And show your work. Right? There had been 40 years in the wilderness, and we spent some time on that, didn't we? We even talked about the reason. Because when the 12 spies were sent into the land, the 10 who came back with the majority report basically came back with a fearful report. They came back with the idea that, it was characterized as an ill report on the land, and so we ought not to call it something else. But there was a sense in which it was really an ill report on themselves. Because they said the land indeed does flow with milk and honey, but it's full of giants. Now, how are we going to overcome giants when we're not giants? And so we talked for a while about becoming giant killers, didn't we? You have to have a giant killer attitude, a giant killer mindset for God to use you as a giant, for God to use you to kill giants. Now, that 40 years then became 40 years of judgment on the previous generation. Basically, God determined, okay, you were in the land for 40 days, for 40 years, you're going to wander around in the wilderness until this entire generation dies. And sure enough, only two from that entire generation were able to enter into the land. And who were they? They were the two spies who brought back the good report, Joshua and Caleb. So with respect to the previous generation, those 40 years in the wilderness were a time of judgment. Can you see that? I mean, when you die as a result of God's telling you you can't do what he called you to do, how is that not judgment? But having said that, having acknowledged that it was a time of judgment for the older generation, it was a time of training for the younger generation. And so, have you ever heard the term wilderness experience? Do you know what I mean when I talk about a wilderness experience? There are just times in our lives, have you experienced this, where it seems like things just aren't going the way we thought they would? Has that ever happened to you? Yeah. We call that a wilderness experience. And it can be a time of judgment, or it can be a time of training, a time of learning. And for the younger generation, the generation that would enter into the land, what was God teaching them? God was teaching them every morning, when you get up, there's going to be food out there because I'm going to provide for your every need. They got food from heaven. They had water pouring out of a rock. Now, that almost never happens. And yet they had water coming out of a rock, and then that water actually followed them through the wilderness. They'd get up and follow that cloud. If they followed the pillar of cloud, coming along right behind them was that stream of water. And when they got to the new place and sat down, it began to pool up for them and for their livestock. That's a miracle. That doesn't happen normally. That's a marvelous, miraculous provision for the people of God. So an entire generation of children grow up thinking what? God's going to provide for my every need. If I'm hungry, I just need to go out in the morning and gather some manna. If I'm thirsty, I just need to go over to the stream and get some water. God is providing for my every need. Ah, but can he give you clothes in the wilderness? Deuteronomy chapter 29 says that your shoes didn't even wear out. Now, I don't know what that means, but I've never had a pair of shoes or boots or anything else, any kind of footwear, that lasted 40 years. Have you? I don't care if it is, Lucchese. 40 years is a long time for a pair of shoes. And they didn't have someone to resole it either, did they? So understand that there is some miraculous working going on in the lives of this upcoming generation. Their clothes didn't get old. And basically, God was giving a new generation tokens of his faithfulness and of his power. And he was doing it every single day. So they were sustained in the wilderness. You see, it's not just a question of God supplying food. God could have just as easily made them not get hungry, couldn't he? The idea is that there was food there. God provided the food, but they still had to gather the manna. There was still some gathering involved. The water was there, but they still had to go out and dip the water. There was clothing there, but they still had to get up and put on their clothes every day. And so it is with God's provision. When He trains us about His provision, He doesn't train us to sit back and fold our arms and expect things to drop into our laps. What He trains us to do is expect that with the diligent use of right and lawful means, He will provide, even in the wilderness. So, He had furnished Moses with tokens of His presence in Exodus chapter 4. You remember the burning bush and snake, the rod that He threw down and became a snake. He provided Joshua as well with the same kinds of tokens. And the Lord, remember back in Joshua chapter 1, had spoken to Joshua. And after Moses died, He said, "Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given to you." Sounds like a promise, doesn't it? Well, it is a promise, but your foot's going to have to do some treading. Then He says, "Be strong and of a good courage." Then in verse 7, "Only be thou strong and very courageous." And then verse 9, "Be strong and of a good courage." Now here's why they need to be strong and of a good courage. It's not going to be easy. They're going to have to keep God's commandments. They're going to have to believe God's promises. But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It's going to require courage. It's going to require manliness. Then in verses 12 through 18, Joshua once again commanded the 2.5 tribes that already had their land to stay with the covenant community as they conquered the rest of the land. Starting at verse 12, "To the Reubenites, to the Gadites, to the half-tribe of Manasseh, spake Joshua, saying, Remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, The Lord your God has given you rest, has given you this land. Your wives, your little ones, your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side Jordan, but ye shall pass before your brethren armed, all the mighty men of valor, and help them." So understand here that there is a promise, there is a command, and there is also a cooperation among the members of the covenant community. No one person is doing all this. Everyone is working together. So we see that in verses 12 through 18, the 2.5 Transjordan tribes. Next, we have the story in chapter 2 of the 2 spies who went into the land. And if you look down at verse 24, chapter 2 and verse 24, they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has delivered into our hands all the lands, for even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us." An odd thing happened. You know, when Rahab sent the police one direction, and then she sent the spies a different direction? You remember that part of the story in Joshua chapter 2? A strange thing happened in the sense that the police got all the way out to the Jordan. They had to have been able to see, because this is a plain. This is on the plains of Moab. It's not a problem to see 3 miles. They had to have seen that there were 600,000 men plus their families and livestock 3 miles away. But they did nothing. And the reason I think they did nothing is because they said they can't cross the Jordan anyway. They're over there. The Jordan is so swollen up over its banks that they can't possibly get across. We don't need to worry about them right now. All we have to do is make sure there are no spies over here in the land doing sabotage and terrorism. But beyond that, we don't have to worry about those 600,000 guys over there. They're on the other side of the river. Now, that's an important thing for us to keep in mind, that when God caused the Jordan to be swollen in that season the way it was, and it was flood season, so don't think that there was a little trickle of water. It was flood season. It was extremely swollen. The reason that the police didn't expect the Israelites to come across the Jordan is the same reason that they could not get across the Jordan themselves. In other words, God was using that river to protect His people. Now, that's going to become important when they come up to the Jordan and stand there for 3 days saying, now what are we going to do about this? For 3 days, God's going to leave them with no answer. They're just going to stand there next to the bank of the swollen Jordan River and say, you know what? We can't get across that river. We don't have any boats. We don't have anything to build pontoons from. We don't have any bridges. We can't get across that river. So for 3 days, they're faced with the fact that what the police had already discovered. Jordan can't be crossed. Not right then. So for 3 days, they stood there and did that. But we'll come to that. Then in chapter 3, basically, Joshua presents the people of God with a glorious opportunity to believe him. Now, many times the opportunities that we have to believe God are presented to us as though they were obstacles to be overcome. Have you ever noticed that in your life? Have you, if you've been paying attention, you have. You've noticed that many times obstacles come into your life and you say, man, now what am I going to do? There's nothing I can do. And you find yourself in a position where the only thing you can do is believe God. And so it becomes a glorious opportunity, a marvelous opportunity for you to trust God all over again. Now, that's what Israel is going to have at Jordan. They're going to have an opportunity to trust God. So let's look at this passage in its order. Because chapter 3, basically we have a new venture beginning. But that new venture is going to be regulated by the promises and commandments that they've already received. What commandment have they already received? They've already received the commandment, be strong and of good courage. Be strong and very courageous. Be strong and of a good courage. That's the command. The promise is, every place you set your foot is going to belong to you. That's a great promise, isn't it? How many of you, if God gave you a promise, if God somehow or other, in a night vision, was to reveal to you that every place you walk tomorrow would belong to you, how many of you would go out and get yourself a brand new set of walking shoes? You betcha. Of course we would, because there's a marvelous opportunity to believe God. But it does mean you're going to be doing some walking. And the more walking you do, the more of that place is going to belong to you. Every place you put the sole of your foot, God said, is going to belong to you. So let's look at these things one after the other. There was a barrier there, but the barrier, I put it to you, was for the purpose of testing their faith in the promise of God and their obedience to the commandment of God. So it becomes a glorious opportunity to believe and obey God. What do we have to do to be happy in Jesus? Who knows that one? What do you have to do to be happy in Jesus? Trust and obey. For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. And now they're going to be given an excellent opportunity to do just that. To trust and obey. Do what you're told to do. So Joshua, look at 3:1. Joshua got up around noon. You know what? Here's what I think. I think if I had a sure promise from God that every place I put my foot tomorrow was going to belong to me, I'd want to get as much daylight walking in as I could. That means getting up and getting up early. It doesn't mean turning back over in bed and pulling the covers up over your ears. That is the life of a sluggard. Go to the ant. Figure out these things, Solomon says. Don't you realize that there's no taskmaster standing over that little ant saying work? She just works. And the same thing ought to be true of God's people. Joshua got up early in the morning so he could go to work. See, well now, what is early? Does that mean 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock? It means in time for you to dedicate the entire day to God. Joshua rose early. And similarly, by the way, this was a habit of his life. Look at chapter 6 and verse 12. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of God. In fact, I only remember one person sleeping during the daytime in Scripture, and that would be Samson. And he laid his head down in Delilah's lap and took a nap. And you all know how that turned out, right? Yeah, that did not have a good ending. So when we say make hay while the sun shines, that's a good scriptural principle. So in 6:12, Joshua rose up early in the morning. And 7:16, the next page, chapter 7, so Joshua rose up early in the morning. And then 8:20, the page after that. And when the men of Ai looked around them, they saw, and behold, the smoke of the city ascended up to the heaven. Well, I got the wrong one. There it is, 10. I've got 20 written down, but 10 is the correct reference. Joshua 8:10. Joshua rose up early in the morning. So here's what we're seeing in Joshua. Is a habit of life, aren't we? Joshua doesn't know anything about weekends. Y'all know what a weekend is? That's the time you sleep in, take it easy, lay back, pull the covers up over your head. Joshua doesn't know anything about that. Joshua says, no, sir, it's morning, it's time to go to work. Now, I put it to you that that should be characteristic of Christian people, that we should be up in the morning and we should be working in the morning. Like the greater Joshua also got up early in the morning. If you look at Jesus' life, once again, consistently you find him getting up early. In fact, sometimes he got up so early that he just stayed up all night. But when he stayed up all night, it wasn't for drunkenness and such. It was to pray for you. So it's all right to stay up all night, but you need to be praying. So the Christian then is to be characterized by industry, by getting up, by going to work, and not by sloth. Joshua was no lover of his own ease. He didn't just like to lie around. What do we call that today? An A-type personality? No, here's what we call it, a successful man. You can call it A-type, B-type, I don't care what you call it, Z-type. If a person rises early in the morning and goes to work every day, works 6 days out of seven, and tithes on the increase, here's what I'll promise you, success. And it's not on my authority, it's because God promised you success. If you do that. Now, that doesn't mean that you can pull the covers back up over your head and say, well, okay, I worked real hard yesterday, so I'll take it easy today. If you do that, there's no promise. The promise is to the person who is diligent and is diligent in his work. His heart was in his work. And that's how you can tell. Do you know why a person sleeps in the morning? Do you know why? Because he doesn't enjoy what he's doing. Now you think about this. How many of you like to fish? How many of you like to fish for the early fish? Right? But you have no trouble getting up to go after that early fish, do you? Because you like it. You enjoy it. This is something I love to do. And so it doesn't matter how late I was up the night before packing the car. Come 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, those covers are going to be thrown back and my feet are going to be on the floor. Well, that's the way Joshua felt about doing all of God's work every single day. He loved doing the work of God, and so every morning those covers were thrown back and every morning he got up. And we also should be diligent in our work. I think I quoted for you this morning 2 Timothy 2:15. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. A workman. Do you know what a workman is? It's a man who works. Doesn't mean you're a slave. Doesn't mean that you work for somebody else. But it does mean this. You're a man who works. You have a reputation as a worker, as someone who gets things done. That's why you always give the most important project to the busiest people. Wait a minute. Shouldn't I give the most important project to the person who doesn't have very much to do? Never. It's always the busy person who knows how to get things done. Well, that's what Joshua was. Joshua was a person who decided that the day started in the morning and not halfway past the morning or even into the afternoon. Joshua, you see that? 3:1. And Joshua rose early in the morning. And he didn't just lie there and say, you know, this is my prayer time. He rose. That means he got up out of bed. Now, there may be ways of making money while you're just lying there, but there's not many. Secondly, notice that they moved from Shittim to Jordan. Shittim is, some of you will recognize that as a Hebrew plural. It comes from the name of a tree, Shittah. And this is going to become important next week when we begin to talk about the ark. The ark was made out of Shittim wood, acacia wood. Shittim was likely an acacia grove. You all know the acacia tree? How many of you know what a mimosa tree is? That thing that has the beans and it has the purple feathery looking flower? That's an acacia, or in Hebrew, shittah. It's a tree that they made a lot of the furniture for the tabernacle from. Anyway, they removed from Shittim to Jordan. And here's the significance. Moses brought the people all the way up to Shittim. Shittim was the place where the baton was passed. Now, this is the moving in faith that God has given them the land. Now, think about this. As they're walking, here's what they're seeing in front of them. A river that is swollen to the point where they can't get past it. And what do they keep doing? They keep moving toward the river. Now, that speaks well of their faith. Here's what they're doing. They're saying, I'm going to go as far as the path is open. And when the path is no longer open, it's God's job to open the path farther. But I'm going to keep going. As long as the path is open, I'm going to keep on going. This is moving in faith that God has given them the land, that the land will be theirs, and it's obedience to the command to go take it. The principle then is this. Proceed along the path of obedience until God makes you stop. And then trust God to open it further. Trust that God will take that obstacle out of the way. Say, well, if I just knew how God was going to remove that obstacle, then I would go forward. That's not faith. That's walking by sight. And what does Paul say? We walk by faith and not by sight. We walk by believing the promises of God. That right now, God has told me to keep on walking. And when I get to that river, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know this. God said, head west. And I'm heading west as long as I can. And that ought to be the nature of our faith and obedience as well. We proceed along the path of obedience until we can't. And then we trust God to open the way to further obedience. So what kind of examples are you talking about? I'm talking about keeping the commitments that you have made. Say, right now, perhaps some of you are wondering, I'm talking to you single guys and single ladies, you're wondering, I'm not sure God really has a woman for me. I can't see it. They're not sitting here. They're not anywhere around me. I can't see it. I can't understand it. You're walking by sight, brother, and not by faith. Here's what you do. You proceed along the path of obedience. That means you don't even consider marrying a non-Christian or a nominal Christian. You all know what I mean by nominal Christian? One who is a Christian in name only. Don't even consider that. Don't even think about it. That's not the path of obedience. Say, yeah, but it's hard. I know it's hard. You know what's even harder? Disobedience. So you proceed along the path of obedience as far as you can until God stops you. Then you pray to God to open the way so you can proceed in obedience even farther. Young ladies, the same thing is true of you. When Mr. Wright doesn't come along this year, don't next year settle for Mr. Hildo. You hold on to the hope, to the promise that God is going to make you a patriarch or the mother of thousands and tens of thousands in their generations. You hold on to those promises. You believe those promises, and then you walk as though you believe those promises. Does that make sense? It really doesn't. It requires faith. You can't believe this and walk by sight. If you believe this, you understand it means that there is a fellow out there for me. There is a young lady out there for me. I just don't know who it is yet. I remember when John Murray was a confirmed bachelor, and when he finally did get married, he was very nearly 70 years old. And the woman that he married was 27. And that was a big encouragement to some of us single guys, because we figured, you know, our wife could be born any day now. But that's what you need to do. Understand that God is out there in the future controlling events even though you can't control them. And that's the nature of faith, right? Is understanding that God controls what we don't. We can't control it, but God does. God understands these things. He sees the end from the beginning. Then third, that was second. The second thing was they move forward in faith, in obedience. The third thing is this. After 3 days, the officers went through the host encouraging people. Look at verse 2. It came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host. Now, host is just an old-timey word for army. The officers? What officers? Well, how many of you have been in the military? How many of you are vets? Okay, you don't have any question what it means by officers, do you? The officers went through the army. And the officers are the guys in charge. The officers are the guys who have the battle plan in their hands. So after 3 days, the officers went through the host. Now, understand that this army is not merely an army of men. These are not just soldiers with uniforms, but a congregation of men, women, children, baggage, animals, foodstuffs, carts. It's a multitude. And the officers went through them all. And the reason that they were stopped is because they were blocked by the river. It came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the host. They came to the river and they lodged there. They got as far as the river and they stopped because they could not go any farther. After 3 days, now understand this. A day comes and goes, a night comes and goes. A day comes and goes, a night comes and goes. A day comes and goes, a night comes and goes. A day comes, and now the officer shows up. Meanwhile, you've been sitting there looking at the river for 3 days and three nights, saying, you know what? I'm completely out of ideas how to get across this river. I have no idea how I'm going to do this. But here comes the officer on the fourth day. And so they were blocked by the river and they were left for those 3 days and three nights to consider their own helplessness. Have you ever been left by God to consider your own helplessness? Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever reached a point in your life and you say, you know, I thought I had some of these things settled, but now all of a sudden I realize there's no power in me. Has that ever happened to anybody else? Am I the only one? Maybe some of you right now have reached a point in your lives where you're wondering, what is going on? The very same things that used to work. I remember, I was heading west. I was putting one foot in front of the other. I came to this river, and here I've been for 3 days. Now what do I do? Well, here's what you do. You consider that God wants you to know you are at the end of yourself. You are at the end of everything you can do. You're not in charge anymore. Now He is. And that's what the officers were telling the people. They were saying, man, watch what God's going to do next. This is going to get you excited again. You can't believe what God's going to do to this river. And that's the way it is oftentimes with us. When we see the circumstances on our life, God puts those circumstances there. He puts those obstacles there with one primary purpose in mind, and that's to humble us. You see, God loves a humble spirit. And God will do whatever He has to do to humble us. So, it's good to know things. It's good to do things. It's good to be active. It's also good to be humble. And many times God puts things that we can't know, we can't learn, we can't do in our way to teach us. We might be such a much compared, but we're not such a much compared to God. And so, how long does that obstacle stay there? Until we learn that we can't deal with it. It's beyond our ability. Now, some of you have known me long enough to know that I've come up against something like that very recently in my life. Nothing you can do. We don't have church jail. So what do you do in a case like that? Well, it's humbling. Here's what it does, is it teaches you, it ain't up to me. It's up to God. If we're going to get past the Jordan River, if we're going to enter the land, I would have been preaching this a lot differently a year ago. A year ago, I would have told you, follow me. I got this thing figured out. You just stick with me. We'll do it. But you see, God's humbled me in a major way by showing me that it ain't all up to me. That if it's going to be done, He's going to be the one who does it. And so we come to that River Jordan, and God sometimes just leaves us to sit for a while and think about the fact that He's God and we're not. So after 3 days, during those 3 days, there was some necessary preparation that had to be done. Now, this is the background to a miracle. This is evident. You know, we've now completed the translation. It's now available. In fact, I think it's even available on CD. But we have supervised the translation of the Psalter into the Burmese tongue. You know, what a marvelous thing that those people who were not a people have now become the people of God. But one of the psalms, and I would say probably the favorite of some of the Chin people in Burma, is Psalm 107. And the reason it's so favorite for them, listen to some of the words of Psalm 107. Listen to verses 5 and 6. They were hungry and thirsty. Pardon me, starting at verse 4. They wandered in the wilderness in a solitary way. They found no city to dwell in. Hungry and thirsty, their soul fainted in them. Then they cried unto the Lord in their trouble, and He delivered them out of their distresses. Can you imagine a jungle people who have no city, no place? And in fact, the place where the village was located last year might not be the place where the village is located this year. They wander in the jungle. And now they cry to the Lord, and the Lord hears them. And so you look at the big cities in Burma, and did you know that on the top of the Shwedagon Pagoda. The Shwedagon is the chief Burmese Buddhist site in Burma. That on the top of it is 54 metric tons of pure gold that's been put there one leaf at a time. 54 metric tons. That's a T-O-N-N-E. 2,000 kilograms. No, pardon me, 1,000 kilograms. A metric ton. 54 metric tons. Say, man, what a treasure the Buddhists have. But they don't have the gospel. The Chin have no gold. They have no land. They're moved by the army from one place to another. But they have the gospel. And they cried to the Lord. And the Lord heard. And he answered. And then, verses 12 and 13. Therefore he brought down their heart with labor. They fell down. There was none to help. Do you know that they have conscripted labor in Burma? That an army man, an army squad, can simply come up to anybody they see working and say, now you must come and work for us. Because they have all the guns. Therefore, he brought down their heart with labor. They fell down. There was none to help. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble. And he heard them out of their distresses. Can you see how the Chin people might love this psalm? Verses 18 and 19. Their soul abhors all manner of meat, and they draw near the gates of death. And then, just when they had nothing left to eat but a handful of rice, they cried to the Lord in their trouble. And he saves them out of their distresses. And in verses 27 and 28, they reel to and fro. They stagger like a drunken man. And they're at their wits' ends. But they cry to the Lord in their trouble. And he hears them. And he delivers them out of all their distresses. Now, beloved, if God can hear slaves in Egypt, and if he can hear the jungle people in the Chin state of Burma, do you think his ear is closed to your cries? If an obstacle comes in your way, at least you've not been beaten down by the military, by the Egyptian taskmaster. At least you've not had things taken away from you that you've earned. Well, except for the tax man. But the point being this, you cry to the Lord, and he hears you, and he delivers you out of your distresses. Many times the reasons you have distresses is simply to teach you to cry to the Lord in your trouble so that he can show himself mighty on your behalf. Now, we mustn't minimize our difficulties. When something is wrong, when something is not going the way we expected it to go, when things are topsy-turvy in our lives, we should not simply kid ourselves and say, you know, everything's fine. Everything's okay. It's not bad under the circumstances. We should not minimize our trouble. We should say, rather, there are great obstacles standing before me, and unless the Lord delivers me, I don't know how I'm going to be delivered. I don't think it's possible for me to do it. I think it's just too high for me to go over, too wide for me to get around, and so deep I can't dig under it. That obstacle's there for sure. But more sure still is the word, the promise of God. And that's the way we need to think. Cry to the Lord. Recognize the difficulty, and then appreciate what God is doing. That is the background of a miracle. The background of a miracle is you coming to the end of yourself and realizing there's nothing you can do for yourself. Like a woman who's been bent over for 12 years and can't stand up. And she comes to Jesus and says, I can't stand up. And he said, I know the solution. Stand up. And she stands for the first time in 12 years. A man comes to him with a withered hand and says, I can't even put my hand to my mouth. And Jesus said, I can fix that. Stretch out your hand. We don't know what we can do until we give the problem to God. And that's what the people learned to do in those 3 days that they sat at the edge of a swollen river. They learned, we're not going to do this by ourselves. We don't have the power. We can't get over that river. We can't get around that river. We can't dig under that river. God's going to have to do something about this river. What Jordan confronts you? Isn't there a Jordan in your life right now? Isn't there something that seems to you that if this doesn't go away, it's the end of the world? I know that all the promises of God are yea and amen, but this sure looks like no to me. Give it to God. Let Him own that problem. Don't minimize the problem. Don't say, it'll go away. No, it won't. You give that problem to God. You let God deal with that problem for you. And just like the man with the withered hand, next thing you know, you're reaching out for the promises of God. Just like that woman that had been bent over for 12 years, next thing you know, you're standing up straight. And how did that happen? You gave it to God. Just like the children of Israel standing at the Jordan River. Fourth, notice in verses 2 and 3 what the officers commanded the people. It says that the officers went through the army, they went through the host, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then ye shall remove from your place and go after it. Now, you can almost hear some skeptics saying, well, what if they head for the river? But that's exactly where they're going to go, isn't it? That's exactly where they're going to go, is for the river. And the fact of it is, we have to have an ensign, a signal, a sign, a rallying point for the people of God. It's rather like that lost battalion that as the Germans were just killing left and right, they were scattered every place. You couldn't find where they were. That someone yelled out, bring the ensign to the company. And the man with the flag said, no, bring the company to the ensign. And so it is, we must bring ourselves, our friends, our neighbors, our co-workers, all those with whom we come in contact, to the ensign, to Jesus Christ, to Jehovah Nissi, to that one who is lifted up before us, to that one who holds us up as well. The officers commanded the people. They were confronted with a real challenge, a real misery, a swollen river. And here's what they said. You get behind the ark and you go after it. You stay with the ark. And that's almost exactly what Jehoshaphat said in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. And for those of you, again, who have known me for more than just a short while, know that this story of Jehoshaphat's victory over the Moabite-Ammonite conspiracy is one of my favorite passages in all Scripture. I'll tell you what, I could preach that one every week. I love this passage. And at least three psalms came out of this story. But at verse 12, here's what he says. Our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us. Neither know we what to do, but our eyes are unto thee. You see what Jehoshaphat's? Our eyes are upon thee. Verse 12. 2 Chronicles 20, 12. 2 Chronicles 20, verse 12. I don't know what I've been saying. I should have been saying 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 12. I don't know what to do. None of us know what to do. This problem is way bigger than we are. But our eyes are upon Thee. We're looking to You, Lord. And the same thing happened in Numbers chapter 21. Remember all the people were snake bit? And there's only one way that they could be saved from that snake bite. Only one way. There's no antidote, no making X's and sucking the venom out. What do they have to do? They have to look to the brazen serpent that's been lifted up in the wilderness. Do you remember that? Jesus refers to it in John 3:14 and following. They have to look to it. They have to put their eyes upon it. So it is in the Christian life. Here they have to look upon the ark. Here they have to follow the ark. Today, we're called also to take a cross. Not just to follow a cross, not just some procession where somebody out front is holding a cross out in front of us, but rather to abandon all hope in ourselves. How much hope can you have in yourself if you're nailed to a cross? What do you do now, Mr. I can do it all? If you're nailed to a cross, there's nothing you can do. And that's what we're called to do. Take up a cross. Get up there on that cross. Reckon yourself dead. Reckon yourself without strength. Because in reality, you are. And we have to be brought to such a place to be made usable by God. I believe that one of the reasons that we don't have the Dwight Moody's anymore, the Charles Spurgeon's anymore, the John Calvin's, the John Knox's anymore, is because we're all out of broken men. No longer do we have men whose hearts are broken by God, whose spirits are contrite. We now live in a generation of people who can sit down with a business plan and tell you exactly how the kingdom is going to progress. Here's how I'm going to do it. And while we do want to have plans, we do want to understand that God has made us promises for the future, we also want to understand that He uses broken men. Dwight Moody, one of the men I just mentioned, used to characterize the life of Moses this way, that God spent 40 years when Moses was in Pharaoh's palace teaching Moses how to become somebody. And then when he was chased out of Egypt and lived on the backside of the desert for 40 years, God was teaching Moses for 40 years how to become a nobody. And then for 40 years as he led the children of Israel, he was teaching Moses what he could do with a somebody who becomes a nobody. And that's the way we need to think as well. We need to keep in mind that it's about Jesus. It's about the Lord. It's about turning the world's eyes to Him. We have to be brought to a place where we abandon all hope in ourselves and place all our confidence in Jesus Christ. And then notice in verse 3, in Joshua 3:3, the people, the officers rather, say to the people, when you see the Ark of the Covenant. This Ark is central to this passage. That's why I don't want to spend much time on the Ark today. I want to save it for next week because the Ark really is central to chapter 3. It was a coffer or a chest, a box. The word ark is simply a word that means a box. Yes, it was Noah's box. And here it's the box of the covenant, the ark of the covenant. Now, it was made out of that same shittim wood. It was made from the shittah tree. It was made from acacia. But then it was covered with pure gold. The cover that went on top of the box was the cherubim, whatever cherubim are. There were two cherubim that were facing inward, and their wings whatever their wings protruded from covered their faces, covered their eyes as though they couldn't look. They bent over. And that covering, I think we have it translated in the Authorized Version as mercy seat. Does that sound right? The mercy seat that sat on top. Now, here's what's significant. It contained the law of God. When he says, look to the ark of the covenant, make sure you're looking to the ark of the covenant, understand what's inside that ark of the covenant is the law of God. The very law of God that had been written by God's own finger, so to speak, now resided inside that box. So when he says, keep your eye on the box, the ark, was a depository for the law of God. Thus it was called the Ark of the Testimony in Exodus 26, and the tent in which it was housed, the Mishkan, was called the Tabernacle of the Testimony in Numbers chapter 1. But now I want you to see how these two things fit together. Because there's Bible truth here that if you can accept it, it will bless your heart forever. That covering the law of God was mercy. We cannot stand before the law of God apart from mercy. We must have mercy. God must have mercy upon us, else we cannot stand. It was there on that mercy seat that once each year the blood of the atonement was taken in by the high priest and sprinkled, first for himself, then for the entire nation. That is what they're looking to. They're not just looking to the law. Yes, they're looking to the law. But they're not just looking to the law. They're looking to the law through the mercy of God. That God is mercying His people, knowing that in ourselves we can't keep the law of God. Here, however, even though it's called the Ark of the Testimony in other places, here it's termed the Ark of the Covenant. Or in fact, really the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God. And this is in reference to Exodus chapter 19 and Exodus chapter 24, where the people basically entered into covenant with God. Now, the terms of God's covenant, remember that a covenant has to do with friendship. It has to do with being a friend of God. But that doesn't mean that there aren't terms to a covenant. You all know what terms are? If I'm going to buy your house from you, I'll say, okay, I'll give you 50% down the day I sign the contract, and I'll give you the other half the day I move in. Those are terms. We've agreed to buy the house. You've agreed to sell the house. We're friends because of our arrangement, but there are still terms. Now, the terms of God's covenant are the Ten Commandments. You can't say you're a covenant keeper, but a lawbreaker. If you will be a covenant keeper, you must be a lawkeeper. That's the nature of the covenant. In Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 13, just prior to the second giving of the law, here's what God says. He declared unto you His covenant, which He commanded you to perform. He declared to you His covenant. He declared to you His covenant, which He commanded you to perform, even 10 commandments. And He wrote them upon two tables of stone. How can you have the covenant without having the law? According to this, God's covenant is characterized by the commandment to keep the Ten Commandments. He commanded His covenant. And He commanded His covenant in Ten Commandments. So the promises that God made to Abraham, that this land that the people were about to enter, were withheld from a generation due to their unbelief and disobedience. That generation that refused to go into the land, that generation that would prefer the majority report to the truth, that would prefer the majority report even though it required unbelief and consequent disobedience and murmuring. That generation was kept out of the land. And to them it was a judgment. But God is still faithful. And God, though He kept that generation from entering into the land, nevertheless, God took their children into the land. And as Joshua later testified at Joshua chapter 21, verses 44 and 45, God faithfully gave this land to your father's children, to you. Now, every person, every last person here and out there, every last person in the world must identify with one generation or the other. Either you're the generation that distrusted God, disobeyed God, and were not given the promises of God and died in the wilderness, or you belong to that generation that enters into the land, that believes the promises of God, that obeys the commandments of God, and enjoys the land. Now, the question that I leave with you is, to which generation do you belong? Do you belong to a generation that is willing to give up the leeks and garlics of Egypt, that's willing to give up the flesh pots of Egypt, in order to enjoy a land that flows with milk and honey? Then you must believe the promises of God. You must mix the promises of God with faith. And you must obey God. And if that means standing at a river and contemplating the fact that you can't get across by yourself, then so be it. Let's stand and call upon the Lord.
You have been listening to a sermon by Dr. Richard Bacon of Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed in Mesquite, Texas. For more information on FPCR Ministries, visit our website at www.fpcr.org or contact us by mail at 6702 Dalrock Road, Suite 126, PMB 214, Rowlett, Texas, 75089.